On November the 3rd, the non-profit World Preservation Foundation co-hosted with Dodds Parliamentary Services a unique gathering at the historic Central Hall Westminster in London, with speakers from government, science, media and advocacy organisations to discuss the increasingly evident effects of climate change and explain how the production of food, and in particular livestock raising, is seriously impacting global warming, biodiversity loss, water shortages and more. Leaders Preserving Our Future, Pace and Priorities on Climate Change was attended by experts and dignitaries such as the Duchess of Norfolk, High Commissioner for Antigua and Barbuda, Dr. Carl Roberts, Dr. Esther van der Voort, a representative from the United Nations Environment Programme, and the ambassadors of such countries as Russia, Bolivia, Nepal, and others. The highlight of the afternoon was the presence of Supreme Master Ching Hai, who delivered a message via video on solving the large environmental crisis of concern in the meeting, as well as urging leaders and co-citizens alike to make courageous, earth-saving changes. We now invite you to join us for part two of the seven-part rebroadcast of the live conference, Leaders Preserving Our Future, Pace and Priorities on Climate Change, on November the 3rd, 2010, in Westminster, London, in the United Kingdom.
Chris Williamson is the Shadow Minister for Communities and Local Government, and high among his priorities are measures to combat climate change, including energy efficiency. If you put your hands together, please.
Well, thanks very much indeed for that introduction, Chair.
I'm merely a relatively newly elected Member of Parliament, was elected in May this year, and have been... promoted to the front bench covering local government. But certainly I recognise that climate change is the biggest challenge facing the planet. And as politicians, we've absolutely got to grasp that nettle. The problem is, of course, that politics, given the electoral cycle, is to a large extent based on short-termism, and it's the next election that people are most concerned about. And, you know, you can have the best policies in the world on climate change, on social justice, on a range of different issues. But if you're not in power to implement those policies, then they are not worth very much in the end. So for me, I think the key thing has got to be to try and build a cross-party consensus, similar in a way, really, to the cross-party consensus that was developed on the welfare state and on the National Health Service. More important, that we've got to try and develop that kind of cross-party consensus on this whole agenda. Now, the government has said it wants to be the greenest government ever, and they've, as you probably know, launched the Green Paper on the Green Deal, and hopefully that will move things forward in terms of taking this agenda on. My background is in local government, and I do believe there is a lot that local government can do around climate change. And certainly in my new role as the Shadow Minister for Local Government, I will be promoting the role of local councils to actually do whatever they can to help. Now, that's not just in terms of local government getting its own house in order, reducing its carbon emissions, though there's much they can do in that regard, in terms of how they deal with waste and so on, and, you know, reducing the need for landfill. And there is a statutory driver on that in any event that obviously local authorities are moving that forward as a consequence. But there's more that they, I think, can do in terms of their whole place-shaping agenda. And when I was leader of Derby City Council, we set ourselves a target to make Derby a sustainable city by 2025, self-sufficient in clean, green energy. And we wanted to build a consensus with other public sector organisations, but also, most importantly, really, the wider general public and the business community in Derby. And some of the initiatives that we worked on were initiatives that actually helped to win the hearts and minds of businesses in the city. particularly small and medium-sized enterprises, looking at how we could, through energy efficiency measures, for example, improve their bottom line. But I think we did, you know, win a lot of people over to what we were trying to achieve. It also included a radical transformation of public transport in our city. So there is a big issue that we need to, I think, address there. We've got to actually, you know, tackle this on a cross-party basis, it seems to me. We need to try and build that cross-party consensus. I will continue to do what I can in that regard. But we've also, I think, got to win the hearts and minds of the wider general public. And that means, I think, looking at how we can encourage people to look at lifestyle, how they can encourage people to perhaps eat less meat, given that the livestock industry does contribute to a large extent to climate change emissions. Got to find a better way forward, I think, where we can see people's livelihoods, their lifestyles, their standard of living not being diminished over much, that we can try and keep people in employment. And I do think there are some opportunities in that regard in terms of the whole new green jobs which could be created that will, I think, help to address that conundrum which can be created. And I do think we are beginning to, as I say, develop that cross-party consensus. Certainly that's what I'll be seeking to do. And obviously, I'm just a layperson. It's a topic I'm very passionate about. I'm in, not in the same league as the eminent speakers that, that have spoken today, but certainly I would be keen to work with people in this audience on the platform today to help me actually make the arguments in the House and with colleagues to try and, you know, win people over to what I think is the most significant challenge that, that we face as humankind. So hopefully we can move things forward, and with your support, we will make a difference.
Thank you, Chris. We're now going to have Professor Simoa. Now, interestingly, of course, John Topping in his speech touched on the fact that reducing CO2 alone is not sufficient to address climate change in the near term. And Professor Simoa is going to be speaking about the presence of black carbon in Antarctica with its high global warming potential, which is a great concern, and its reduction as an important strategy for reducing global warming. So we're going to have this speaker and then Dr. Esther van der Vogt. So put your hands together, please.
Good morning. Thank you for the chance to talk a little bit about the work in Antarctica and the question of black carbon. In some ways, I may add information to the lecture of Mr. Topping. Maybe I should begin that presentation with a statement that is becoming clear here. One of the greatest difficulties for the general public to understand climate change has been too much emphasis on the question of greenhouse gases. All the important factors are involved. And this is the case of black carbon that I'm going to talk a little bit now. So, what is black carbon? First, it originates from the incomplete burning of biomass or fossil fuel, and is basically formed by small, high solar radiation absorbing particles. And by now, I'm going to show the evidences. We know that they are spread from Arctic to Antarctica, elsewhere in the world. They are very tiny particles, between 0.01 to 1 micron in the atmosphere. As Mr. Topping told you, it stays in the atmosphere just a couple of weeks, but is available to disperse it at longer ranges. BC, or black carbon, belongs to short-lived pollutants, and then comes the most important point, is the second most important contributor to the global warming. In fact, the potential of black carbon is estimated to have 55% of the radioactive forcing effect of carbon dioxide. And in short, BC absorbs light and heats the atmosphere. So, along the 20th century, as we have the increase of black carbon production due to the consumption of fossil fuel, developed countries have improved the efficiency of that burning and reducing it by the end of the 20th century. But not as true in a lot of countries that are industrialized at the moment. So, the thing that we have in this picture here is the main places that we have biomass burning at the moment, at the year of 2009. As you can see, mainly in the subtropical and tropics, not only in South America, but also in Africa and Australia and some countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, and others in Southeast Asia. So we can place the following question. How this kind of material can be transported to Antarctica? It seems a long way. For the last 10 years, we have changed our idea about the transport of air masses from South America or from the tropics of South America to Antarctica. By now, we know that cyclonic activity is able to transport materials in a short time, in a week or so, from the main areas of biomass burning to the south, and then mainly to the northernmost part of Antarctica, that is the Antarctic Peninsula. Interesting enough is to know that as the air masses are coming south here, we have cold air masses going to the north, up to the south of the Amazon, of course, to balance the energy budget of the Earth. So it's a two-way movement, and here I would like to do a parenthesis about the impact, about the places that it is really happening, this kind of biomass burning and transport into the south. It's a myth that it is in the middle of the Amazon that we have biomass burning. It is happening, in fact, in the Brazilian savanna, known as Cerrado, and in the frontier between the savanna and the Amazon forest. It's really related to the expansion of cash crops and cattle farming, a point that should be considered in the discussions this afternoon. So, cold air goes to the Amazon forest and biomass burning products to Antarctica. Do we have some evidences? That's a research result for the last couple of years where we had at the same time atmospheric measurements and ice core, we collect cores, to measure black carbon in the northmost part of Antarctica. And what you can see in that graph, you have the red curve that are the number of fire spots in the Amazon forest or in the south part of the Amazon forest. And at the same time, in the same snow and ice samples, we have the concentration of black carbon, and it really goes together. We are having the transport of black carbon to Antarctica. Important, in the Himalayas, the increase is much higher, threefold increase in black carbon from 1860 to 2000. The same thing has been observed in the Swiss Alps. Why it's important? Because black carbon impacts the surface of snow ice mass as it reduces the surface albedo, the proportion of energy that's reflected by the surface. It is increased melting, trigger albedo feedback, changes the glacier mass balance, and contributed to glacier retreat. In short, black carbon is as important as atmospheric warming for melting surfacing of the glaciers. Thank you for the attention.
Thank you. And our final speaker of this session is Dr. Esther van der Voort. This summer, the UN Environment Programme issued the report assessing the environmental impacts of production and consumption. And we're delighted to welcome today one of the report's lead authors to talk about why a substantial global diet change is the only way to reduce one of the most important drivers of environmental pressures.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, I work at Leiden University, the Institute of Environmental Sciences, but as the chair said, I'm one of the authors of the UNEP report. The UNEP resource panel, they produced a report called Assessing the Environmental Impacts of Production and Consumption. Edgar Hutt, which was actually the lead author of that. I was one of the co-authors. In this report, we looked at the various worldwide categories of consumption, sectors, and also resources and materials to see, well, which one contribute most to environmental impacts. And the conclusion out of this report really was, and I will go into that a bit later, is that agriculture and food are really important contributors to environmental impacts, including but not limited to greenhouse gas emissions. Well, options to reduce this were not really the topic of this report, and next report will go into that in more detail. And of those options, a diet change seems to be the most effective one. So this is, in brief, the topic of my talk. In view of the topic of this event, the non-CO2 greenhouse gas emissions, agriculture is especially a relevant sector. Because methane is a greenhouse gas that's emitted in large quantities from cattle, and the climate forcing potential of methane is a lot stronger than that of CO2. Same for laughing gas, N2O, that's emitted from soils. It's a product of incomplete denitrification of fertilizer and manure. And that's an even stronger climate-forcing gas, and it's connected especially to agriculture. That does not mean that agriculture is not associated with the CO2 emissions. It is, and especially via the energy input in the agricultural chain, like, for example, via fertilizer. Agriculture is also associated with other environmental impacts, and the ones to name especially is land use and water use. This is one of the, well, results out of the UNEP report. Here you can see the contribution of the various consumption categories to greenhouse gas emissions worldwide. And here you can see the green part, that's food. It does not just include the agricultural sector, but also the upchain, the production of fertilizer, the production of other agrochemicals, the agricultural practice, like driving around in tractors, that's all included. Also the food processing in those percentages. So it's significant. Another angle to take is resources or materials, and that's where these pictures come from. They are not for the world, but for the EU countries. Here you can see the leftmost bar represent just kilograms of consumption, and the largest part is minerals for construction, so it's sand and gravel, basically. Agricultural materials you can see in the red and orange a little higher, the red one being the crops and the orange the animal products. But if you calculate not just the kilograms but the environmental impact connected to it, you can see the size of those different contributions of the materials change. For the global warming potential, you can see that the sand and gravel contributes almost nothing. But for agriculture, the bars are a bit bigger than in the kilogram ones. Land use competition, of course, agriculture dominates since it's by far the largest land user of the sectors. And then there's a human toxicity bar. And in the end, the rightmost bar represents all environmental impacts added to each other. And here you can see that agriculture, and especially animal products, contributes a lot. Now, if you look a little below that, this picture represents greenhouse gas emissions of agricultural products in kilogram CO2 equivalent per kilogram. So on the left, you see a lot of different crops, while on the right, you see the animal products. And if you just look at it through your eyelashes, you can see that the greenhouse gas emissions per kilogram are a lot higher for these animal products than they are for the crops. And also, you can see that there are a lot of differences. So one animal product is not equal to another one. These two pictures, the leftmost represents the worldwide consumption of different agricultural product groups. You can see the cereals on the left, and the vegetables and fruit, and then the oil crops. And on the right, you have the animal products, meat, fish, and dairy. In kilograms, the consumption is high for the vegetable products. But if you multiply that with the greenhouse gas emission per kilogram, you can see that they are almost equal. So although in kilograms the consumption of meat and dairy is less, in terms of their greenhouse gas emissions, it's equal. How come? Well, one of the reasons for that is that in these calculations, the upchain is included. So the greenhouse gas emissions for animal products are not just caused by the animal production sector, but they also include the production of animal feed and all the upchain processes that come before that. Well, summing up the evidence, so to say, we can see that agriculture is a large contributor to global environmental impacts, including but not limited to greenhouse gas emissions, and that the share of animal products in this is important and also is increasing. These are differences between regions in the world in food consumption. You can see that the OECD countries, the rich countries, they consume the most animal products. It's the brown and the blue bar. It's the meats and the milk. It's about half of the diet. In Russia and the former Eastern European countries, also a lot of meat is consumed. But if you look at Asia, it's a lot less. The contribution to the total food package of milk and meats is a lot less. Partly this has to do with welfare, with how rich people are, but not completely. If you look at this one, you see that within those regions in the world, there is a huge variety in the amount of meat that's actually eaten. Even in the OECD countries, it varies from 140 kilograms per capita to 20 kilograms per capita. So this is a huge difference, and you can see similar differences in the other regions of the world. So on the one hand, it shows that diets are really sort of independent of income, of welfare. On the other hand, it also gives the message that you can be rich and have a lot of welfare without eating a lot of meat. And you can see also in the richer countries that it becomes fashionable to have more vegetarian aspects in your diet. So that gives some hope that actually something can be done about it. Thank you.
We've already heard about what shorter-lived climate forces are, and our next speaker is Dr. Xianhui Ku, co-founder of the World Preservation Foundation and a renowned chemical and engineering sciences researcher based in Singapore. Dr. Ku's main research areas are life cycle assessment of greenhouse gases and the carbon footprint of food, bioenergy, and strategies to reduce global warming. Today, she'll be talking about the structural causes of non-CO2, shorter-lived climate forces. Please, would you put your hands together whilst holding your cups for our next speaker?
This year, the world watched in shock and sympathy as we witnessed Russia try to put out massive fires and as a fifth of Pakistan was submerged underwater. Many of the world's developing nations, who are the most vulnerable to climate change, has been calling for global average temperature increase to be no more than 1.5 degrees. We need some urgent solutions to stop the trend of mean rising temperatures and prevent any further climate-related disasters. We also now realize that reductions in carbon dioxide, which was at first all the efforts put to stop climate change, will not create cooling in time. Researchers and engineers, including myself, have carried out extensive research on carbon capture and sequestration technologies for more than a decade. I can confidently conclude that we are far from having a technology that is advanced enough or that is affordable enough to even start to bring us towards a carbon neutral economy. And supposing we are able to create such an advanced system, one that can extract all the carbon dioxide out of the air right now, we have only just solved part of the problem. The bigger and more urgent magnitude of climate change lies in reducing shorter-lived greenhouse gases. Our understanding of climate science has evolved in the past few years. Perhaps the best solution suggested by scientists for the fastest recovery of the climate is to reduce shorter-term climate forces, methane, black carbon, and ground-level ozone. These gases exist in the atmosphere for a shorter period of time than carbon dioxide. Ground-level ozone lasts for about 22 days, black carbon for about months, and methane 12 years. Reducing these shorter-lived climate forces can lead to immediate climate benefits because the Earth's climate system responds quickly when these pollutants are removed from the air. And one of the most powerful ways of bringing these emissions down is through dietary changes. According to the UN, the primary source of human-caused methane is livestock. From these charts, we can see that in the United Kingdom, 43% of methane emissions come from livestock, and in Brazil, 75%. There are suggestions to capture methane and convert the gas into bioenergy. Unfortunately, this approach has to be applied in closed factory farms to make it easier to capture the gas from animal waste. This suggestion will only create another problem, since closed-space factory farms are breeding grounds for all sorts of disease and illnesses. They also do not address the other environmental challenges created by animal proteins, including land use change, high water usage, deforestation, nitrous oxides, and biodiversity loss. From a life cycle food chain perspective, such approach is known as shifting the environmental burden from one compartment to another or from one type of pollution to another. Around 50% of the black carbon that was deposited around Antarctica was from the biomass burning found in South America. When black carbon is deposited on ice and snow, it absorbs solar energy and accelerates the melting of glaciers. This further adds to the warming of the planet. Large amounts of black carbon, carbon dioxide, and methane gases are released from the burning of forests, or rather, from the destroying of what's considered the precious lungs of the planet. And the reason for deforestation? To create land for cattle grazing and for growing soya directed to feeding these animals. It has been estimated that cattle ranching is the cause of between 70 to 80% of deforestation in the Amazon. We can clearly see by now that the livestock sector and dietary patterns are key contributors to a range of critical environmental problems we face today. If these non-carbon dioxide gases continue to be emitted, the ecosystem of this planet that has supported life for eons of years is on the brink of spinning out of control. The logical, simple, and practical solution to reduce methane, black carbon soot, and ground-level ozone pollution is to shift away from animal farming or to shift away from meat-based diet to an entirely plant-based diet. Plant-based proteins offer a wide range of environmental benefit from every angle of its life cycle perspective, from farm to food. A single-level food chain in place of a double-level food chain have the advantages to reduce pollution, free up land for restoring the forest, offer health benefits, and ensure food security. The Netherlands Environmental Assessment Agency reported that, based on a diet with no ruminant animals, the cost of climate change can be reduced by 50%. However, by switching to a diet with completely no animal products, including no fish, the cost of mitigating climate change will drop by more than 80%. We are facing a whole spectrum of problems caused by climate change, from atmospheric emissions to water stress and contamination, and from food shortage to rising health costs. Solving each and every one of these individually will cost a lot of time and a lot of money. One simple step solution that is affordable to everyone and doable is to switch from a meat-based to a plant-based diet that will in turn resolve many of the other associated problems at hand. each and every one of us contribute to climate change, including myself. But we can also be the ones who control climate change. Eating plant-based foods is something that is easy to do and have a very significant positive effect. The World Preservation Foundation is calling for the support of everyone to control climate change by increasing plant-based meals in our diet. Thank you.
The thing I didn't realise is that dairy and cheese aren't particularly very good for your health either. I kind of known before about the meat production being unenvironmental. It'd be have a huge impact if more people went vegetarian. I mean, everyone would be lighter and happier, and they wouldn't need so much medication, wouldn't need such huge healthcare. There's huge implications. And I think that the lady from America, Lisa Bloom, she's so beautiful and thin and lives on a vegan diet. If you've got a walking advert like that, it's, well, whoa.
Your goal is to end all animal farming. Why do you believe this is needed, and how can we go about doing it?
A more compelling reason, and I think one that really should drive the political decisions, is that it is by far the most environmentally destructive activity that humans are engaged in. And of course, there's the methane emissions associated with farming and all the other sorts of greenhouse gas emissions associated with, but it's a huge opportunity to deal with this looming climate catastrophe, basically. I think by far the easiest way to do it. It's animal farming, period, the whole shebang. You don't solve the problem by saying, okay, well, we'll just, you know, have this little idyllic farm where the cows are wandering around eating grass and their manure is fertilizing the plants and all that kind of stuff. That doesn't solve the problem.
Thank you for your warm-hearted presence for today's episode of Words of Wisdom. Please join us again tomorrow for part 3 of Leaders Preserving Our Future, Pace and Priorities on Climate Change. Now, please stay tuned to Supreme Master Television for Golden Age Technology, coming up next, right after Noteworthy News. May heavens bless you and your loved ones with much love and abundance.
For more details, please visit www.suprememastertv.com/WOW